One, if you think you're ever going to get ahead of the wave and you work in the technology space, you might not be in the right space. Because as you and I both know as engineers, technology changes all the time.
Hello and welcome to CloudMonk.com. I am your host, Anand Kumar, and I work as a customer engineer at Google. For more such podcast episodes, super simplified lessons and content on cloud, please check out www.cloud-monk.com. That's www.cloud-monk.com. In this episode, we talk with Amina El Sharif, who works as an AI/ML specialist at Google Cloud. In this fascinating conversation, we talk about Amina's journey, starting off as a computational linguist to working as a spy. Yes, you heard that right, a spy, to being an AI/ML specialist. We also talk about AI ethics, AI literacy, when to use generative AI, when not to use generative AI, how she keeps up with everything happening in the Gen AI space, etc. We also talk about her next fiction book, her secret to generating creative ideas, all this and more. You don't want to miss this jam-packed episode with Amina. So sit back, grab your favorite drink, and enjoy the show. Hey, Amina. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Anand. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Before we get started, Amina, I know you have a very extensive and interesting background on how you got to where you are today. If you can give the listeners a background of your journey, that would be awesome.
Yeah, so I assume when you mean where I got to today, it's being an AI and machine learning lead at Google. So I'll go on that assumption. So I started my undergrad in computational linguistics, but I was really interested in the linguistics part and less interested in the computer science piece of it until I joined the military here in the United States. And the military basically told me that there was no way I was going to get a security clearance that I needed to become what I wanted to do, which was be a spy. I spoke and speak several languages, so that's what I wanted to do. And, since I was young, who doesn't want to be a spy? So they told me, hey, based on your background, I'm originally Egyptian. And based on your background, we don't think you're going to get a security clearance. And so we're going to shove you over to the IT and networking side of the Army, because, that's where we put the people, right? So not a very glorious turn of events for me, certainly definitely not where I saw my career going, but it's funny how things work. I ended up going to the first iteration of the cyber training at the U.S. Army Cyber School in Fort Gordon. And from there, kind of got launched into my technical career. I was dealing with a lot of really large data sets. Surprise, surprise, I did end up actually being a spy. But I got to do technical things at the same time. And I dealt with a lot of data in my job. And there wasn't a whole lot of automation put into place, especially where I was working at. In the special operations field. And so that's when I started to kind of explore coding, basically out of necessity, not really because I wanted to learn. But I was a one-person shop, and so I had to kind of automate myself to a certain extent, or else I wasn't going to get the job done. Fast forward a couple years from there, I actually broke my back on a jump during my military service and ended up in bed for 3 months. And so, of course, the first thing that came to mind was, what am I going to do with my brain while I sit here like a vegetable in bed recovering from a broken back? And so I did that classic kind of, well, I'm going to join a boot camp and learn a little bit more about this coding thing because it seems interesting. I could do some fun stuff with this. And the next thing you know, I graduate from the coding boot camp. On a whim, apply to Google. This was back in 2016, and somehow made it into Google. The last part of my journey getting to the machine learning piece of working machine learning at Google was, as I mentioned, joining Project Maven, and suddenly I was launched into the world of computer vision. And I'm a fully taught, self-taught machine learning engineer at this point. Now, of course, recently with LLMs becoming super popular, I think Google kind of folded in on itself and was looking for people who had experience in that field. And being a computational linguist, that's kind of, you know, one of the few things that we are experts at, is understanding how language interacts with really electronic systems of any kind. It doesn't have to be code, and it doesn't have to be machine learning. So yeah, that's how I got to where, that's like the longer maybe version of how I got to where I am today. I've been at Google off and on for the last 6 years. And yeah, I'm still in public sector, but I work with, well, frankly, all the customers that we have under our umbrella. So federal, defense, state and local governments, education. I kind of work with all those different kinds of customers.
That's awesome. Thank you for that background and laying out your journey for the listeners, Amina. There's so much I want to double click on in what you said and talk more about. But let me start off by saying being a spy, wow, that's like so cool. I had no clue you worked as one, so that's fascinating. You also mentioned that you started off as a computational linguist, and now you're a large language model specialist. It must be interesting, right? Because in a way, you've taken a full circle and back around to your love for language, right?
Yes. Yeah, it is funny how everything did kind of circle back to that without me really meaning to. But yeah, it's funny how things come around that way.
Awesome. And you had mentioned about Project Maven. Would you mind, is that something that we can talk a little more in detail about Project Maven and what that was?
Yeah, I mean, from a personal standpoint, absolutely. I can talk about my experiences there. There will obviously be a few things that I can't share, but I'll go in areas where I can go, I guess. Let's just put it that way.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, if you could just give us like a little bit of background on what the Project Maven is, and you know, what should people know about it, and what was what happened to Project Maven now?
Yeah, so this is all public information. It's been out in the news with various, you know, as news goes, interpretations of what Project Maven was and what Google's role was in the project. But basically, the premise of the project was Google building machine learning algorithms and models for the Department of Defense on non-lethal drones. That was the platform that Google worked on specifically. It was an interesting computer vision problem in the sense of, you know, we were working with platforms that are like Zeppelins or blimps, right? They operate at really high altitudes. And so Google was charged, you know, in a strange kind of way of technical scoping, charged with detecting very small events and small items in kind of a classification context. From, you know, satellite data or overhead data that was extremely far away, right? So we were asked to detect, you know, hey, can you show men that might be armed, right? They might be carrying guns or RPG launchers or something like that, and be able to detect it from very high up, right, in altitude, which, as you can see, just as a technologist, it's like the setup of the problem was destined to kind of bite us in the butt, so to speak, in my opinion. But yeah, we were also asked to do things like be able to count the number of kids that came in and out of a school, for example. And this is, you know, a very common workflow that all military services use prior to doing anything, right? Whether it's an airstrike or whether it's a ground raid. If it's, you know, and in Afghanistan, for example, schools have been used, you know, very, very prolifically. This is also public by the Taliban in the past as places to store weapons or places to put a lot of precious things under, because, you know, it was known that the United States wouldn't strike a school full of children. And so it was tasks like that. So we had to be able to count humans, and a human would be like half a pixel, right? Because these shots that we were getting were so far away. So the kind of thing that Project Maven was known for is bringing the conversation of AI and ethics to the forefront, which is really kind of how the larger company at Google got involved. And it really brought the conversation of what does ethics and technology mean together when it comes to large technology companies working on projects that might feel or seem to be controversial, right? There are several of these kinds of projects that exist today across all vendors, but, you know, very existential questions that were happening at Google, like, hey, do we support the US government? Do we work for the US government? Do we work with entities like ICE or DHS or the Border Patrol? All those types of questions that were coming up that were really kind of dividing Google in some kind of way from an ethical and moral standpoint. I think ultimately the decision that was made by Google was that, yes, you know, as a US-based company, we will work with not just the US Department of Defense, but a lot of other governments to be able to provide technology in now, you know, after Project Maven, an ethical way. And that's how our AI ethics principles were born. Is a group of people got together at Google following the Project Maven incident and formed the AI ethics charter that we now follow today, not just for AI, but I think for all the technologies collectively that we implement across the space.
Interesting, very interesting. And fast forward from that to today with the generative AI space. I mean, I know you're at sort of the forefront of it. I've just started to get a hold of the LLMs and generative AI, and I can easily say that this is a field which is drastically changing almost every other day. Yes. And you have been at the forefront of it. You're the AI ML specialist in our organization. How does that translate? I know you talked about some of the ethics conversations which was there at Project Maven. How does that translate to the generative AI world? And also, how do you manage everything that's going around from the Gen AI space?
Yeah, so I'll tackle the first question first. And the first question is actually super interesting. There are lots of different ways that I, after being through so many AI ethics, just, you know, it felt like rotations in general between Project Maven and other things that I've been involved with. Initially, when this technology started surfacing, when OpenAI revealed ChatGPT last November, can't believe that was a year ago, there was a part of me that was very, very angry about the way this technology was being introduced to the masses. Because the way it was introduced was, it really wasn't introduced at all. It was just kind of thrown out there, and people just started consuming it. And so you start to see a lot of, like, anywhere from TikTok videos to Reddit threads of just the general masses in all over the world, not just in the United States, being like, what is this? Is this an intelligent being? Is this a supercomputer AI? Is it, you know, that nobody knows any more or any better, because the general AI literacy in the global population is very concentrated amongst a few people who care about it, or typically that's how it's been in the past. But now what is happening, and as you and I may or may not know, generative AI is based on something called transformers. And transformers' job, all this mathematical algorithm is supposed to do, is predict the next word or words in a sequence or in a sentence or in a pattern, right? So this can also be applied across pictures. So technologies like Midjourney, and DALL-E are just predicting what the next most likely pixel should be in a picture. Mm-hmm. And so it's really not self-aware nor self-intelligent in any way. It's quite clunky, actually, at the end of the day, in terms of actually making LLMs and generative AI useful for, you know, large enterprise applications. But the masses didn't understand that, right? They didn't know that all this model really was a really good prediction machine. And so a lot of chaos was happening there. And I think that kind of escalated the ethics conversation around generative AI but also kind of distorted it in a lot of men in a lot of different ways, right? We have people who are now exclaiming that, you know, generative AI is passing the bar exam. Well, of course, if you haven't memorized all of the content that's in a bar exam, it's going to pass it because that's what it's designed to do. Machine learning is just mathematical algorithms training over and memorizing patterns that are seen in data.
Mm-hmm. So sort of like a super powerful autocomplete, if you may, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we're at. So that was the first interesting ethical conversation that I think, you know, how this technology was ushered into the space, I think could have been done a little more responsibly, but at the same time, it might have not made the splash that it did if it had been done in an explainable way. So that's, you know, left for debate. And of course, the other ethical conversations around generative AI that I carry over from my days at, you know, Project Maven is, are LLMs and generative AI actually the right solution for a customer's problem, right? So since generative AI has become this new sparkly magical dust, it feels like customers are coming to me every day and kind of ditching anything that looks like traditional machine learning, which, like, I would not call neural networks traditional at all. There's still a lot that we don't know about them. And wanting to just slap generative AI onto a use case or solution to make sure, at the end of the day, it's a case of FOMO, right? Nobody wants to feel like they're missing out. And that causes a lot of ethical issues too. The most recent one I ran into, for example, was, well, is it actually ethical and appropriate use to apply large language models and something like ChatGPT or Bard against math problems? Because neither, like, large language models in the transformer, core transformer architecture is not designed to do math. That is not what it's actually designed to do, is mathematical computations, even though the system itself is based on matrix multiplication, which is ironic. They're actually not very good at doing math consistently. And so I run into this in public sector, right? Because I've got all kinds of customers that either want to do something education related, or they want LLMs to do all of their finance and accounting analytics for their whole departments, right? So there are some more kind of, does the glove fit the hand ethical mm-hmm. questions that I think should be the focus of ethical conversations around generative AI, as opposed to, like, is the technology inherently evil? Because it's not. It has no intention. Mm-hmm. It just is a really good prediction machine. The second question that you mentioned, how do I keep up with it?
Mm-hmm.
I'll be completely honest, with large language models, this has been kind of the hardest phase for me to answer that question. So here's what I generally tell people and engineers especially. One, if you think you're ever going to get ahead of the wave and you work in the technology space, you might not be in the right space. because as you and I both know as engineers, technology changes all the time. And if there's any expectation for one single person to have the bandwidth to be able to absorb what's happening across the entirety of the technology space, even a highly specialized space, mm-hmm. like computational linguistics, my example, it's not going to happen. So don't expect it, right? But in the meantime, what you can do to try to keep up with things is, I love my newsletters. I use newsletters a lot, both internal at Google and external newsletters, to make sure that other people, especially researchers or people who specialize in areas that I care about, like AI and machine learning, mm-hmm. Can filter out what's important for me. It can be a really, really long, dark, deep rabbit hole if you go out there and just start reading research papers on different methodologies and you don't have the ability to filter them. Especially in generative AI right now, the plane is being built as we fly it. Mm-hmm. The people who are building the systems that we are using now, like Bard, like ChatGPT, any of them, or anything offered on the enterprise side, everyone is actively putting out research, and then the machine learning engineers that are building the product are consuming those research papers the same week. Right. And then trying mm-hmm. to go back and evaluate product and see if these research methodologies fit. And so It's an interesting time in technology, and everyone should not feel panicked because everyone feels like this. Mm-hmm. Of like research, like you said, is coming out every day, and all of us are getting shook every morning when we log in, like, oh, there's a new retrieval system, or now there's a new theory behind how to ground hallucinations, for example. So I love my newsletters, and I also put my logic hat on when it comes to all the new products and research that's coming out nowadays on generative AI, just to kind of look at all of them with a grain of salt and a healthy dose of skepticism in terms of what works and what doesn't, and what I should pay attention to and what I shouldn't. So hopefully that's helpful.
So that is actually very reassuring, because I had this imposter syndrome saying that, you know, whenever I read something about Gen AI, then there's a new article which comes out. I'm like, oh my God, I have to catch up to that. So yeah. It's good to know, like, especially because we represent some of the organizations that created this technology. When we go have this conversation with the customer, they're expected to say, hey, you're Google, you should be knowing this. I know we have an army of resources to help, but at some level, we sort of get like, you know, an imposter syndrome. I should know this. Let me go back and read over the weekends and extended time. So, but it's good to know that, you know, there's no way to keep up at this pace. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's you can try. Obviously, with all those research papers, definitely use some kind of LLM to summarize. Yeah,
exactly. That's what I was hoping. Like,
right? Yeah. But no, I mean, don't expect yourself to stay even remotely up to date, because that's going to cause a really horrible, frankly, like cycle mental health wise. So I know I've spoken about this a little bit, and a lot of other people at, you know, Google and other companies that I have relationships with. I mean, people that are working in the LLM field right now are really tired and they're also really excited. But I think a lot of them are really tired because this past year has just been so fast. And if you try to keep up with all of it, you have to realize even hype cycles are marathons. They're not sprints, right? Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to pace yourself, even when everyone else seems to be losing it around you. That's the only way to stay healthy in the field and sustain, right, your work.
Agreed. Yep, I totally agree on that. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, Amina, with respect to you know, how you felt like the way the technology was released in November 2022 for ChatGPT might have been better. Like, I just wanted to give you my perspective. Like, I was on the other end. Like, I did not know much about machine learnings or neural networks at that point of time, but I was just an avid consumer, and I felt this was amazing. Like, this technology, and that led me to start reading and getting more curious about how this technology works. But I know you said this might not have been the best output. Sort of genuinely curious from your side, if you had to rewind the clock and go back to November 2022 and you had the controls to, you know, make this release in a more controlled way, like, what would be the ideal scenario that they should have come out?
Oh, gosh, I don't know if, I mean, the classic story that I use is, you know, we came out with the Transformers paper, which is the attention is all you need paper, back in 2017, right? So it's not new. And the research has been steady and building since then from the computational linguistics community. There was a Googler who, you know, you may or may not remember, was actually fired from Google back in 2021. And he was fired because he mentioned something about, you know, hey, there's something that Google's working on. It's a sentient being. It's a sentient chatbot. It's able to express human emotions and feelings. That's where we were in 2021 with this technology, right? So I imagine OpenAI and the folks there were in a similar place. I don't know who made the judgment call to finally unleash ChatGPT onto the world. If I had been in charge, you know, which is above my pay grade and I shouldn't be in charge.
Just hypothetically.
Right? If I was in charge, I think I would have done things in a very similar way to attract market attention, right? So like the attention that was attracted by this new tool being released was really phenomenal, right? So the marketing piece was great. What was not great is ChatGPT ended up getting a bad rap because there were things like the Samsung leak and people putting in personal information. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ChatGPT auto-training on all of the data that was put into the system. So from a product perspective and a marketing perspective, I think I would have done things very similarly, but what I would have changed mm-hmm. were things like, one, educating people on what the system actually is, right? So maybe including something in the UI or the user experience that educates people very briefly about what it is they're about to interact with. Mm-hmm. The kind of, you know, analogy that I used of, you know, or actually you brought it up of these technologies being just really powerful autocompletes. Something to that effect needed to be communicated to the end users so that they knew that there was no sentience behind the technology that they were using. I think that would be a really good disclaimer to put on all AI-enabled products, at least for now, right? Until the general human population becomes used to it, just like, you know, the Industrial Revolution was disruptive back then. This is going to be disruptive now. 10 years from now, we're going to look back on this conversation and go, why were we so worried? At least that's the hope, right? And the other thing that I would have done would be what we all have done and Google did from the get-go, which is one, not train on whatever the users put into this unknown system that they know nothing about. So don't retrain on that data. Or if you do retrain on that data, make it very clear that you do, right? So put a disclaimer or something to that effect that mm-hmm. says, hey, whatever you put in here, like it's going to be part of, like anyone else could access this information. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, aside from the launch and how it happened, obviously you're an engineer, so you get this, like we could continue perfecting the technology for another 5-10 years if we wanted to. But I think on a consumer level, the technology is ready. On the enterprise level, I think we have a little bit of a ways to go to make it enterprise ready. But as a fun consumer tool, it certainly was, you know, released and caught attention that way. I think I would have just taken a few extra steps, like I mentioned, mm-hmm. to kind of make sure that there were the right disclaimers on the product to educate end users a little bit more about how to use the tool in a way that wasn't going to hurt them at the end of the day.
Makes sense. Essentially, you're saying have more guardrails, but the go-to-market itself strategy was fine, but just more the guardrails perspective. And I think it is very similar for me. Like when I got access to this tool back in November, it felt like magic, right? But the more I read about this and the more I understand like the Transformers paper and how it works behind the scenes, once you unveil the curtain, it just feels... oh, it's just a very fancy autocomplete. So some of the magic component is like died down, but it's still like amazing how this technology works.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. It definitely still continues to amaze people every day in terms of what Transformers are actually capable of doing. And I think we're discovering new capabilities that architecture introduces, like we've agreed. On almost a daily basis. And what that does is it unlocks some really good use cases for a lot of enterprises that want to use large language models and generative AI. Mm-hmm. But what it also does is it creates a very unstable and shaky ground for businesses who do want to integrate that technology because it's developing and moving so fast. They really have to stay on top of it if they want to do anything truly unique or truly groundbreaking. With any of these generative capabilities that are coming to the table.
Makes sense. And I know you had also mentioned that, you know, we want to pick and choose use cases, not just rub AI on it for everything, but just have it for specific use cases, which is, you know, sort of tailor-made for that particular purpose, right? What would be like some of the interesting projects that you've worked on in this space, in the generative AI space, something that, you know, we can disclose publicly, any interesting projects that you've worked on?
Yeah. So in proper fashion, I'm going to go ahead and highlight, I guess, proper machine learning engineer fashion, because, and the reason why I say this is, historically, when I've scoped in machine learning projects for customers, because machine learning has been kind of the bleeding edge of the field of AI for a while now, what I generally like to do with high-risk technologies is two things. One, I'd like to advise to start integrating those high-risk technologies in areas of the business that are not high-risk for the business, as in customer-facing or, you know, potentially in an area that might cause significant harm to the business overall. Or at an individual level, if you're an app developer, you know, developing an app that uses LLMs for maybe things in the background that are mundane tasks that need to be automated, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the use cases right now that really excite me, because it's frankly where generative AI is the most reliable at this mm-hmm. point. Mm-hmm. So some of the use cases that I've seen that have been pretty magical in my corner of the world, public sector wise, have been things like, let's use generative AI to go out and crawl government websites with public data and make that data available for our employees to chat with and be able to extract insights from. This is especially useful for basically any government agency you can think of under the sun, but also all of the companies that are commercial that serve any part of the government area, right? So as an example that I've interacted with, I deal with a lot of education companies and education technology companies. A lot of those companies serve public school districts. And so they need to be able to extract information from government websites on a reliable and automated basis in a low friction way to be able to do their jobs, right? So one use case is, hey, let's just go out and systematically index that information and then have an actual quality either chat or search and retrieve conversation over that information. Another use case that I really like is using LLM capabilities to co-create code. The reason why I like that is obviously code and the code base in general has been a really big part of the training data set for a lot of these large language models. And because they've been trained on so much code, and coding is essentially kind of a hyper-predictive exercise in and of itself, even as a coder, LLMs are really good at generating code. So now if you think about where you can apply that in a lot of back office tasks, you could have LLMs writing SQL queries for you programmatically. You could have LLMs deploying infrastructure for you programmatically in the form of Terraform scripts and kind of automatically generating those. You have LLMs creating websites now. These are kind of low friction or low hanging fruit use cases that are also low risk, that are really good areas to start integrating generative AI without the potential for like the entirety of the business to collapse because you surfaced a chatbot that now turned into, you know, someone rude or didn't exactly answer the question that a user needed, or it had, you know, a couple of bad interactions with a user, right? So those are the use cases that I'm especially interested in now, are those kind of boring back office task use cases that can be automated with a high amount of ROI to the business that might not look sexy, but actually does save a lot of time and man hours.
Agreed. Yeah, I think I've had more luck with those kind of use cases as well. So I totally agree on that. I know initially you had said, you know, LLMs are not meant to do mathematical calculations. And these are some things that, you know, the listeners and the general public might not be aware. Like, what are some of the use cases that GenAI, I know you mentioned some of them, which is not good for, but what's one thing that people misunderstand the most about how GenAI works?
Oh gosh, I think the thing that people most often misunderstand, and again, this is kind of due to the way and the novelty of the way that ChatGPT was unveiled to the public, is that I can ask this model absolutely anything in plain English, and I will get back exactly the answer that I want, right? That instant gratification mindset keeps coming back to haunt us, right, when it comes to unleashing new technologies. When you look at the area of prompt engineering and how that area is so robust right now, one can only conclude that large language models, as anything beyond like a creative companion or a novelty tool in the consumer space, really does need this new type of engineer that understands language semantics, aspects of language, combined with someone who understands kind of general programming structure. I wouldn't even say needs to know how to code, to be able to actually get the desired results systematically and programmatically from generative AI, right? So when you start looking at things like prompt engineering techniques that are popular right now, like React, like RAG, like chain of thought prompting, like tree of thought prompting, this whole new field has now blossomed. And I think that is a good indicator of two things. One, that generative AI is not for everyone. It's not quite at that stage yet, although I think we'll get there very soon. And that two, that generative AI right now needs a kind of more sophisticated, more concentrated look in order for it to be applied in the correct way. It can't just be an end user with a question. And you know, it's just me and my bot just sitting there talking to each other. So I think that's probably the biggest misconception about generative AI right now, is it's kind of this ready-made AGI, fully comprehensive system that can answer all of your questions, when in fact, there's a whole area of engineering that is developed over how to ask the right question of LLMs, right? This is where search was 10 years ago when we had people doing Google dorking, right? People who knew how to use that search bar really well, frankly, using basic components of how programming languages go together and symbols and how to use symbols in your query. So I think that's the biggest probably misconception as it relates to Gen AI right now.
Got it. Yep, it makes sense. And I'm also seeing like the importance of prompt engineering. Like there's certain roles which are dedicated for just prompt engineer roles. So, which is great that the industry is, you know, also the awareness is spreading across and how to use Gen AI. It's not really like a ready-made solution for every use case. For consumer playing around, that's fine. But for enterprise customers, there's like a methodical way to access it. With that said, I know you mentioned like as of now, this is where this technology is. But you also gave the analogy of search, how it was back in the days when we had to, most of the, you know, the auto prompt, you have to like really be good at some of the search terms and the search queries.
Yeah.
But it has evolved a lot from then to now. How do you think, from your perspective, Gen AI would be in the next 6 months, 5 years, and like sort of 10 years down the line?
Well, like, I don't have a crystal ball, but this is probably the question that keeps me up at night the most. and I'm not, you know, I'm not the top expert in the field to be able to be making these predictions, but some of the ones that I have that I think are a little bit more tactical in nature, some of them are a little bit more strategic. I think while prompt engineering is important and it's a big field right now, I think our models are going to eventually get good enough that we won't need, it's going to be like search, right? We won't need that high level of prompt engineering to be able to get what we need out of these LLMs. So I think they'll become sophisticated enough that they will be able to execute without any need for a specialized human at the other end of them. So that's the first prediction that I make. I think that'll probably come in the next probably 6 months to a couple years as the models, as we figure out as engineers what the best approach is for making these models understand and comprehend queries better and prompts better, and figure out more about the architecture of how transformers worked in order to optimize them, right? Not to optimize human behavior and interacting with them, but the other way around. The other prediction that I think I would make is that large language models and generative AI as a whole, instead of looking at them as just a singular capability, will become kind of a permeating platform into every capability that we have, whether it's and every capability that's technologically delivered, right? So it could go as far as writing emails for you, it could code for you, it could manage your infrastructure in the background and provisioning of infrastructure, all the way to being chatbots, all the way to managing your HR handbook, right? So like, these are tasks that generative AI will eventually be able to do kind of end to end in more of a pipeline format, and viewed as another tool to add to your toolkit from a platform perspective when you're evaluating tools, platforms, cloud providers, you name it, you're going to want to see, and I hate to toot my own horn, but at Google, we've launched Duet AI into everything that we do, right? Across the board, mm-hmm. whether it's Workspace, whether it's working in the cloud console, whether it's working in Colab, LLMs are everywhere now. And so it's become more of a platform as opposed to a singular capability. And I think that's going to continue as we see growth in like third-party extensions and third-party integrations and wrappers and this whole like very rapidly growing ecosystem around how and what you can plug LLMs into to increase productivity.
Interesting. So like a personalized agent for everyone, you know, help out in day-to-day tasks, or writing emails or, you know, composing docs, etc.
Right.
Interesting. If somebody had to start off today in the, you know, the machine learning AI space and the generative AI space, what would be the advice that you would give to them, Amina? Like, how should they think about, like, from getting started? And I'll give you my experience. Like, I actually started, when I started reading about these LLMs, I read some of the white papers. But then now I'm also going back to some of the foundationals, wherein I'm reading this book called You Look Like a Thing, and I love you. That book is amazing. It talks about the fundamentals of machine learning, basics of AI, etc. I felt like I should have started off with that book. What is your recommendation from, you know, anybody starting off in this space? What would you recommend as a step-by-step approach to get?
Okay. So as I was saying, I think you and I are similar in the sense that we approach learning a new skill very academically. Let me go read research papers. Let me go read books. Which is great if that's how you learn, right? There are people who learn via books. But I think based on being a self-taught technologist for the most part, going out and playing with the tools is going to be the utmost best way to figure out how they work and what they do and what they can or can't do. I would also advise that even as you or anyone else who wants to learn about generative AI consumes information about the technology, that you try to take a bunch of different facts and corroborate them, right? So if you're learning from one place, you probably want to learn from a couple of other places as well to kind of see all these systems are a little bit different, right? So I think playing with the technology is going to be the number one. Obviously, all of the cloud providers, especially the big ones, including Google and Microsoft, have put out free courses that introduce you to generative AI. I think that's a great additional way to start consuming information, especially if you're more of an audiovisual learner. There are also a lot of hands-on tutorials, whether it's through Medium, which is one of my favorite platforms to get tutorials and information from, or whether it's through something like Quick Labs on Google, right? Like a temporarily provisioned lab environment where you can kind of do a guided walkthrough of what these different technologies are. And then last but not least, the place that I like to get a lot of information from, because this new technology frankly involves so much play in discovery, because it is so researchy right now, is going on to places like Reddit and Stack Overflow and seeing what other people are trying when they prompt models to do certain things, and read about what their results are and what their frustrations are and what they're learning as well. I think the power is definitely in the hands of the community of lay people that are doing and practicing prompt engineering right now in terms of what they're discovering and insights that they're finding out about how generative AI systems actually react to real world situations. So while I normally wouldn't recommend Reddit for much of anything, I would recommend them if you have, you know, like a glass of wine on a Friday night and you need something to do, in terms of, you know, just going out and playing and exploring and seeing what other people are doing and the funny interactions that they're having with this technology, because that's really teaching you the personality of the underlying math and the underlying data that's being exposed through a lot of these systems.
I like that. At the end of the day, like, you know, you said it's, to some extent, it's the community which is sort of shaping where this technology is going, and having going to Reddit is a great way to like be in touch with the community to see how they're playing around with the technology. So that's a great idea. Thank you. I know you know, you're like the Gen AI specialist and you have like a really busy job at work, but outside of your day job, I know you're an author. You've written two books, or is it two books, or have you written more books?
It's two books that are out in the world now. Three books with the one that's in the pipe right now.
Awesome. So how do you so can you give us a little bit of background on what your role is outside of your day job, and how do you get time to, or how do you manage the work in life?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will say that part of my background does not lend to, I wonder about the phrase work-life balance. And I think it's more of a work-life, maybe like pattern or trade-off, or maybe more of like, it's less of like, I work from 9 to 5. And more of like, I do a little bit of work here. And then, I work from home, as many people in the tech industry do. I'm also a single mom, so that's fun in the sense that I get to manage that. And then I also have a very healthy list of hobbies. So that's the first thing I'd recommend for anyone that's looking to achieve that balance, is have a list of hobbies, have a list of things that make you really excited. And also have the self-awareness to be able to identify if one of your hobbies is work. Because if one of your hobbies is work, that's not a bad thing. If you're passionate about technology, or in my case, if you're passionate about language and technology, then be open with yourself in terms of like, hey, messing around with Midjourney at 9 at night after the baby's gone down to bed to create my novel cover. Mm-hmm. While it is, and it feels like work, it's also play. And so I think a lot of us, especially in the technology field, struggle with that, because part of what we do for a living is also a hobby. And so it starts becoming this like, permeating effect throughout our day of like, it feels like we've worked all day, but we've done a mixture of work and play without really realizing it. So having that self-awareness of being able to identify when that level of mixture is healthy and when you need to step away. I mean, there have been a few times where I've had to step away from work in the middle of the day because I found that my heart rate has gone up to my throat, right? Because there's just so much going on. And so sometimes, when that happens and I have a few meetings where I know I'm going to have a passive speaking role, or maybe I'm just learning, one of the really dumb hobbies that I have is building book nooks or tiny homes. I'll sit there and do something with my hands while I'm listening to like, we've had generative AI training sessions that have lasted 2-3 hours in a row. I know my brain, and I know that I kind of need to be multitasking in some sense in order to be able to absorb information and have it stick. So that's another tactic that I've found as well, that helps me out, but maybe for some other people that wouldn't be healthy. And last but not least, especially, and I do this, right, is enforce hours where work is not happening, right? So as you can probably hear, my notifications are going off. When you get to a certain point of the day where you need to turn your work brain off and maybe just play, whatever that play looks like, or you need to go take care of family, turn notifications off, right? Like have notifications automatically turn off. We all know how to do this on our phones. And if you don't, look it up and establish do not disturb hours. And if something comes up as it relates to family, I think it's also very important for every individual to be self-aware enough to be able to write down what their priorities in life are, right? So for me, having my daughter who's just turned 2, she is, and my family in Egypt are my number one priority, no matter what, over work, over, my car and how my car is doing, over how my books are doing, over, everyday, tasks that I have to do. I know that family is kind of my number one priority. And sometimes that means that I miss a few meetings in the morning because, baby threw up when she woke up or something like that, right? So having a list of priorities and knowing what those are, and having work as a first priority isn't a problem, right? That's I wouldn't scrutinize that at all. But I think being honest with yourself about what those priorities are is especially important, so that you can allow your day-to-day play out according to those priorities. And know that sometimes those priorities have to give and take, depending on what's going on in all the different areas of your life. It took me 10 years to write this first book that I'm publishing in the fiction area. That's a long time. So it didn't happen overnight, right? So that's where I think perspective is very important. When you perceive someone to be overly productive, you know, as you are doing right now, talking to me, you start realizing very quickly that overly productive people just know how to healthily manage their time. And the things they're productive in are things that they love to do. If neither of those things held true, then I don't think we'd see a lot of, you know, productive people that we see to our left and right nowadays. So yeah, those are some of, I guess, the nuggets of advice that I would give as someone who does have, you know, hands in a lot of cookie jars, so to speak.
Yeah, very true. I think I agree to that. Like, the prioritization is sort of key, and it's helped me as well in the past. At least when it comes to personally myself, I feel like the phone is my biggest enemy. And anytime I start using it, all my priorities that I had just goes for a toss. And now it's the agenda of, you know, the companies that design those apps, which makes it super addictive. So yeah, I 100% agree. Like, the prioritization is super important. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that, Amina. When's your next book coming up and what is it about?
So the next book is actually a fiction novel. It's my first foray into something called young adult fiction, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's designed for young adults, but anyone can read the book. It's loosely based on my life, having immigrated from the U.S. and joined the U.S. Army. My experience of being a first generation immigrant that came from, you know, a Muslim background and a Muslim country that has a history with the United States and you know, joining the U.S. Army, you know, 9 out of the 12 people that conducted 9/11 were Egyptian. So that was a very interesting journey for me to go through. And so I've been able to, frankly, it's been more of therapy more than anything else, to externalize my experience in the form of fiction. So yeah, it's a coming of age story. It's going to be out on the 23rd of November on all the platforms that you would usually get your books from. And yeah, I'm really excited for the world to experience that story, but also very nervous as well, because it is so personal, as opposed to the first publication I did, which was very dry and on a very technical subject that didn't really require much personality on my end to conduct and serve to the public.
Interesting. How do you, this is again sort of a follow-up question. I know writing fiction and even writing a book for that matter requires some amount of creative thinking, right? Like, you'll have to, at least the way I have seen it, when we zone out and we're not really doing anything, that's when creative ideas come. Like, how do you get, or what point do you get the creative ideas? Like, do you do something specific, like take a walk, etc., or is it just a regular routine? Like, what's the secret to, you know, churn out new creative ideas from your side?
I think when it comes to what has generated the most ideas, first of all, like, to be fully transparent, being a writer and weaving in your own experiences and making a good story out of it, I don't find that original at all, right? Mm-hmm. So what I have done, you know, almost everyone could do if they told their personal life story, it would be very fascinating for a lot of people in many different ways. So my first endeavor into the creative field, I frankly don't consider to be very creative at all. But some of the other book ideas and book proposals that I put in front of my publisher, frankly, all came from travel. It came from travel, international travel especially, but also self-discovery about my own history. So a lot of those ideas have come to me. I carry a notebook wherever I go. I also carry a book wherever I go, which is kind of nerdy and maybe a little bit OCD, but that's okay. Those are parts of myself that I've come to peace with. And whenever an idea hits me, I make sure I write it down. And so every person knows that they have their creative space or their creative process. And so anyone who is in the creative world, which I would consider, frankly, technologists to be creatives, right? Some of us have our witching hours at midnight, right? And that's when we write our best code. So really kind of looking into those moments where you've had some of the best ideas that you have had, don't try to put yourself in that mode all the time, because then you'll be upset and you won't get the level of creativeness that you were expecting. But just passively acknowledge and note when those moments are and allow them to happen when they need to happen. A lot of creatives go in cycles, just like developers do, where they'll have a creative sprint or period of time that goes over several weeks or several months. And then sometimes that creativity dries out a little bit. And you're finding yourself, you know, either writing less optimized code, less interesting code with less ideas, or, you know, in my case with writing, you experience writer's block, which is a really common kind of scary thing that happens in the writing community.
I'm just going to ask, like, when you get a writer's block, like, what are some things that you do? Do you just like take a break from it and then you come back? Like, what's the...
Yeah. So when I have writer's block, I think the best technique that I found for myself, because I know myself, I do have diagnosed OCD, but I'm also just a perfectionist in general, which I think a lot of us are. So it's not really unique to my situation. For those of us who know we have perfectionist tendencies, sometimes the best way to re-engage with that creative mode and get away from writer's block is to disengage. And that's one of the hardest things that we can do. But if you look at the habits of people like Einstein, people like Oppenheimer, people who had to come up with a lot of original ideas, they also took a lot of space away from their job to do other things. And I think that plays into that mode of creativity, if that's the type of creative that you are, which is the type of creative that I am. So sometimes disengaging and going and having a totally different experience that you wouldn't expect would be intriguing at all. Like for me, I'll just go to my favorite bar and sit there and have a drink and listen to people talk. Well, the next thing you know, disengaging from my writing in that way is disengaging from my writing. But in hearing other people's conversations at a bar, you get an idea for your next book or something weird like that. Right. So disengaging can actually be very fueling for your creative endeavor. It just doesn't sometimes feel like that initially for a lot of people who like to keep working really hard and get what they're doing right, if that makes any sense.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. I was recently reading something about diffused mode thinking and focus mode thinking. Like for the most part, when we are focused on a certain object and then when you have like a writer's block, you engage in a diffuse mode thinking activity, which is sort of like you said, you know, something with the engaging the hands, physical environment rather than a digital, or even just, you know, sitting in a bar, listening to other people speak, all of those. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Once again, thank you so much, Amina, for taking the time. Is there anything else that you would want? Again, I'll go ahead and put the URL for the books in the show notes. But anything else that you would want our listeners to know before we sign off?
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I hope that this is beneficial to you, first and foremost, but also to your listeners. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you so much. This is a pleasure talking to you, Amina. I really had a good time.
Thank you, Anand.
Thank you.